It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania, recently conducted a nationwide search to find its next president to succeed James Mullen Jr., who is stepping down after 11 years in that role. The search ended in early January when the College Board of Trustees unanimously elected Dr. Hillary Link to take over as Allegheny College's 22nd president. Hillary Link joins us today. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you so much, Kevin. I'm thrilled to be here.
All right. You have years of experience in higher education. How is this job going to be different from the various positions you've held in the past?
Well, in many ways, it feels like this is a great extension from the roles that I've already had. So currently, I'm the dean of Temple University's campus in Rome, Italy. So I am living abroad. I am overseeing all the aspects of that campus. But that is, for the most part, a study abroad campus where students are living and studying only for one semester at a time. And they're having a very different experience from what they're used to during the rest of their academic trajectory. So what I'm most excited about in coming to Allegheny is to take the experiences and the skills and the programming and initiatives that I've developed in Rome, working with students for one semester, and really be able to spread those out to see students really evolve from when they arrive as freshmen until when they graduate 4 years later.
Yeah, that one semester versus those multiple years.
It's students transform tremendously. And I say this also as the mother of three young boys, one of whom will be going to college in a few years. But having also spent, before going to Rome, 11 years at Barnard College of Columbia University in New York City, I started out there as the freshman dean. And that, to me, was a tremendous experience in watching young 18-year-old women arrive without a sense of what they really wanted to do, and evolve and transform and find themselves by the time they graduated.
A few of the words that keep coming up around your appointment are transformative, innovation, and global. What do those words mean to you in the world of higher education?
So the global piece of it to me is about changing your perspective, seeing things from a little bit of a distance and then understanding them better. Transformative, I think a liberal arts college is a perfect place for students to really find out who they are, how they think, what really excites them, and to figure out how to take the skills and the processes of learning that they're able to develop while they're in college and apply those beyond college into the real world. I think I'm a creative thinker, and I go back to my own graduate studies. I have a doctorate in Italian literature, but my undergraduate studies and my graduate studies were really all about interdisciplinarity. And again, to me, what that allows you to do is look at traditional content in a new and innovative and creative way. And again, it all goes back to new perspectives for me. So my studies have always combined visual arts and literature. And there, I think you enable yourself by trying to look at a text from a visual perspective or look at a piece of visual art with a literary context. It gives you new ideas. And so for me, that creative, innovative enterprise is what a true interdisciplinary liberal arts education encourages students to do.
I hear people saying, hold it, she's trading Rome for Western Pennsylvania. So what excited you about this job?
Oh, so many things. I think Allegheny is such a special institution, and I really think it's a hidden gem. And that's really what drew me to that, to the college. In the same way that I was drawn to Temple Rome when I went there, it was a historic study abroad campus that was doing really good things, but had the potential for so much more. And in Allegheny, that's really what I see. I think the cross-disciplinary, very rigorous academic preparation that the faculty give to the students, that the students seem to want across Allegheny's various majors and departments. I think the connection to civic engagement, a real questioning of what does this education mean and how is it going to be used beyond what I'm doing here on the Allegheny campus is a really exciting proposition. I think that there are really exciting ways that Allegheny can continue to distinguish itself as a liberal arts college that gives students a way to prepare themselves for their life beyond Allegheny, to really be prepared to become global citizens and citizens who can make a difference in this world. And I think in a moment where the value of a liberal arts education is being questioned, I think Allegheny is really poised to do some innovative and creative and unique things.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Dr. Hillary Link, incoming president of Allegheny College. Approximate enrollment right now of Allegheny College?
Allegheny has about 1,800 students.
Is that something you want to grow? Is it the right size, the right fit? What is it?
Well, it's a great question because, and I say this because having not yet taken over as president, I take no credit for this, but I give the college a lot of credit because they've actually strategically reduced the size of the student population over the past several years. And that really was a strategic move to remain very selective and to really resize. The college took a really close look several years ago at where the demographic trends are moving, certainly in Northwest Pennsylvania and all throughout the East Coast, and they made a really bold decision to reduce the size of the student population because they felt like to keep doing well what they do, they were better and they were more selective and they were stronger if they were doing it with a smaller student population.
What is your approach to building upon what outgoing President Mullen has accomplished, but at the same time putting your own stamp on it?
I think that's going to be a really exciting piece of the first, I would say, 6 to 12 months of my presidency. He has done a tremendous job. He is leaving Allegheny in a position of strength. As I said, Allegheny has been forward-thinking. They have a great board that is very supportive, and they've worked together to really ensure the ongoing sustainability and strength of the institution. You know, thinking about the spin that I want to put on things, I think perhaps a more global perspective, more global outreach, and more of an international perspective, only because not just at Temple Rome, but also at Barnard, I've focused so much on the impact of globalization on small institutions in particular. I think the other thing is to continue to develop the college's approach to interdisciplinarity, where, again, allowing students that one of the college's hallmarks is the requirement to do both a major and a minor. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that students have to study two different things in two different areas, social science, art, humanities and sciences, I think it allows them to think about things from different perspectives. And I would like to even further emphasize the ability for students to do cross-disciplinary work, because I think in this day and age, life is complicated and the world is getting ever more complicated. And so having the ability to think across different disciplines and areas is going to serve students better.
President Trump recently signed an executive order protecting free speech on campus. Earlier this year, and of course you're not the president yet, there was an incident at Allegheny College where a student removed an art exhibit because of social media backlash. The large painting has been described as an urban street scene, included the phrase, "kill cops," which was intended to call out hate language, not promote it. The college has been criticized for not supporting its student. But giving that context, what is your philosophy? What is your approach to the issue of free speech on campus?
Well, it's my understanding, again, having not been part of the college, but having heard from President Mullen and from others about the situation, that it was actually the student's decision to work with the college to move the piece of art, not because the student felt like the college needed them to do that, but because I think the student hadn't fully understood how the piece was being interpreted. I believe in free speech, and I believe that on college campuses, students have to feel like they have the space to express themselves, but they have to understand the consequences of their words and of their actions and of their works of art as well. It's the conversation that's really important, because in this day and age, college campuses need to protect themselves as a place where difficult conversations can happen.
You have held some high-level administrative positions at different schools, as we've learned, but never as president. Anything you might be a little nervous about?
I think if it's a nervousness, it's a nervous excitement. The breadth of issues that will arise as a college president, on some level, I've dealt with, but on a much smaller scale. And so to me, it's more excitement than anything else to really be able to work across an entire campus, not just a small satellite campus within a university, but to work across the entire Allegheny campus to create an environment that I'm excited about, of warmth and accessibility and transparency and communication, but also to think about, going back to one of your original questions, the creative enterprise and the innovation that exists within liberal arts, and how can we really leverage that both to a distinguished Allegheny, but also to really support young people moving forward.
You will be taking over as president of Allegheny College July 1st, just a couple months before the new academic year begins. But as you move into that new position, what are you looking forward to learning?
So much. I'm really interested in better understanding the role that Allegheny can play in the higher education landscape moving forward. I think I have a lot to learn, how to focus externally and be the ambassador for the college while also focusing internally and making sure that all the internal systems are running smoothly. But again, as I said, I'm excited about that because it's an institution that I really believe in and I believe is doing such great work.
Dr. Hillary Link is the incoming president of Allegheny College in Meadville. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh Public Schools sells a valuable French oil painting for $750,000 in 2013. The piece, called Interior Light from the Window by intimist artist Henri Lacidonneur, had been donated to the district by a group called Friends of Art after it was on display at the 1933 Carnegie International. The proceeds from the auction were put toward efforts to preserve other pieces of art owned by the district, as well as to make them more accessible to students. The buyer was kept anonymous. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh synagogues are significantly increasing security after the October attack at the Tree of Life Synagogue that left 11 dead. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins explores how houses of worship are trying to balance safety concerns with maintaining a welcoming environment.
On a recent Saturday, worshipers gathered at Rodef Shalom Synagogue for morning services. Couples and families sang and prayed together. To an average worshiper, services don't look any different than they did last October, when a gunman entered the Tree of Life Synagogue just a few miles away. But hidden throughout the synagogue are panic buttons that connect directly to Pittsburgh police. The synagogue used to have 8 or 9 of them. Now there are plans to install more than 50. Barry Weisband is the executive director of Rodef Shalom and says the attack forced the Jewish community to make changes.
We had several meetings with various constituent groups of the congregation. We knew that we had to communicate and hear what their feedback is.
There are now 2 security guards whenever the synagogue is open. They've installed additional security cameras, and visitors may be searched.
it's very expensive to do what we're doing in the road with, that we are going down right now. It's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Rodef Shalom has also provided safety trainings where congregants learn how to run, hide, or fight in case of an attack. Brad Orsini is the director of community security for the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. He monitors security concerns that go beyond the walls of synagogues. In his office, he has files full of anti-Semitic flyers and posters.
Here is an actual picture of vandalism. They put bacon over a rack here, and it says, "You lying people are a disgrace to our community. You live like pigs, so you should eat it too. Oink, oink."
And that's on, like, somebody's porch?
This is on somebody's porch.
He also does the security trainings at synagogues.
We teach our community how to stay alive for 3 to 5 minutes if something bad happens prior to law enforcement coming.
For some Orthodox and conservative congregations, doing activities that are considered work, like turning on lights, are frowned upon or even forbidden on the Sabbath. So Orsini tells them to make sure their phones are turned on before the Sabbath begins at sundown on Friday. And because the preservation of life is sacred in Judaism, dialing 911 during the Sabbath is okay. Those procedures saved lives at Tree of Life. Alan Hausman is the vice president for the congregation.
Well, the rabbi was able to make the call. Up until that training, he had never carried his cell phone on the Shabbat, and members of the congregation used to turn their phones off. So all those people were able to make rapid calls, and it helped.
Tree of Life is still closed off. The sanctuary was untouched, but the building will undergo major renovations over the next several years. Hausman says designing a house of worship that is secure and also inviting is a challenge. They're looking at security guards, cameras, a double door system that would keep people in an outer lobby, and giving congregants a fob to unlock doors.
Unfortunately, the days of just leaving the doors unlocked and people coming in and out are over.
That's true everywhere. There have been shootings at places of worship from Charleston, South Carolina, to mosques in New Zealand. Most recently, another synagogue shooting in San Diego, California. Hausman remembers that new feeling of vulnerability in the weeks after the Tree of Life attack.
I went to a church service of a wedding, and every door was unlocked the whole time. And at a certain point, my wife said to me, "You've got to stop looking at the doors." And I told her at that point, I just could not stop making sure no one came through those doors.
Is the overarching feeling among the congregation that you do want to still be this open place?
We just don't know yet. As you see things like what just happened in California and that, it just opens up all the wounds and starts the fear all over again.
Hausman knows that he and his congregation will never forget what happened at Tree of Life. A few members still haven't come back to services. But there's also hope. A few months ago, Tree of Life celebrated its first bar mitzvah since the attack. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Think superheroes and superpowers. Superman, X-ray vision, flying. The Hulk, super strength. Spider-Man, super senses. Wolverine can heal. Now picture the superheroes of a new comic to be a family. Three kids and their grandfather. And their superpower is their intelligence. Joining us in studio is Joe Woz, cartoonist, founder of the Pittsburgh Toonzeum, and the executive producer of this new project. Joe, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, the new comic. It's called The Invensons. What's the gist of it?
So The Invensons is this story of a grandfather and his family, these kids who are just wildly creative. They have, you know, as the name suggests, just these inventive minds. and it's really about their abilities to sort of cope with, you know, the villain, Balzer, and the situations created by him, and how they use their own sort of creative and just sort of imaginative thinking to resolve those problems and issues. So it's sort of a, you know, it's a superpower, but it's one that we all have.
The creator, George Davison, when he contacted you, what did he want your role to be?
So when George contacted me, first of all, I was just delighted. I'm a huge fan of what he does. I sort of regard him as sort of this mad modern Disney.
All right, and he does, for those that don't know, he was sort of the creator of Invention Land, was he not?
Yes, Invention Land, it works with inventions every day. And so initially he had contacted me, knew my work and asked if I wanted to be the artist on this. And I looked at it and I said, this is great. I love this, but I'm not the person for the artist, but I tell you what, I can pull together a great team. And so I decided to take on the role as executive producer and just pull together just this stellar team of artists, colorists, writers, editors, and everything. So
the Invensons is a nod to, and of course, it's the hometown of these three kids and their grandfather. Invention Land is the name of their town. It's a nod to that incubator you were referring to at RIDC Park in O'Hara Township. So what about sort of an R&D park, just a generator of ideas felt worthy about for cartooning?
That's what's interesting is when you think of sort of these R&D parks, you think of just sort of these bland buildings you go in with a bunch of cubicles. When you go visit Invention Land, there's a pirate ship. There's a treehouse, which is a nod to our publishing, the Treehouse Comics. It is truly this immersive, creative experience. And that's sort of why I saw this as just sort of a perfect fit, because it's about world building, and that's what George does. He builds these wonderful worlds that you just want to be a part of, and it's so creative.
All right, so you gave us a little tease there that the kids, they're all super geniuses, and they're trying to protect their homeland. So what's the deal between the grandfather and the villain?
The grandfather and Balls are the villain. I've always loved good villains. I think that's what makes a great story, is having a good villain. They're lifelong peers. I mean, they work together. They went to school together. And but Balzer's always been a bit jealous of the grandfather's easy success at things. He's just sort of a natural. Balzer has to work really hard at these things, but is a bit on the lazy side, and things always tend to go wrong for him. So they have an interesting rivalry that really is sort of the backbone of the whole story.
And the heroic deeds are about creative ideas and solutions?
Yeah, that really is when you get to the core. It's this idea that we all have within us ourselves to think creatively and solve problems in interesting ways.
Joe, as we said, the heroes are the three kids, but is this comic made just for kids?
It's one of the interesting things about the comics and cartoon genre in general is that things that start out or are really geared toward kids as a key demographic really find a much broader audience. So if you enjoy comics, if you enjoy, the concepts of creative thinking and ideas, then you'll enjoy the comic no matter what your age. But kids are the core demographic, but I think it's definitely appeals to everyone.
So are comics still a popular entertainment vehicle for childhood lessons?
I think they are and really always have been. There's lessons of morality that can be taught. There's lessons of, history and, things like ours, which are dealing with, the ideas of STEM concepts of, science and technology and mathematics. And these are all things that can be encouraged through comics. It's a medium that combines both visual and the written word. So it appeals to a broad range of learners.
We have less than a minute left. So is the goal to inspire kids to be creative in their own ways?
That's our ultimate goal, is to let kids know you're all creative. You all have this ability within you to come up with new ideas. And that's what the world needs. I mean, we need new ideas, new technology, and just new ways of solving problems. And the kids are the ones who can do that.
In a sentence or so, what are the plans for the future for the Invensons?
We have already started on our next issue, and hopefully we'll be seeing this run for years to come. And we want to get out into the schools and make sure people are reading our comics.
Joe Woese is a cartoonist, founder of the Pittsburgh Toonzeum, and executive producer of the new comic, The Invensons. You can find more on the project at invensons.com. Joe, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Allegheny County Health Department is operating a free measles vaccination clinic today for people 12 months old to age 61 who have not been vaccinated. Joining us on the line is Dr. Kristen Mertz, medical epidemiologist with the County Health Department. Dr. Mertz, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Mertz, what kinds of people are eligible to get this vaccine?
So the clinic today is targeted to people who have not been vaccinated. We're trying to reach those who are susceptible to the infection. So people who have not received any vaccine, we would like to have come to the clinic. Alternatively, they can contact their provider and get the vaccine that way.
Who is not eligible? I understand pregnant women, for example.
Right. Pregnant women should not get live vaccines, so they are not eligible. People who are immunocompromised are not eligible either. People born before 1957 are assumed to have natural immunity, so we are not targeting this clinic to them. Mm-hmm. Also, children under 12 months of age are not supposed to be vaccinated unless they are doing international travel.
Is that because it might be a danger to them, or it's not as effective, or what?
Right. The vaccine is not as effective for infants less than 12 months. It's best to wait till you're 12 to 15 months of age to get the vaccine.
How many doses do you have? Do you think it'll be enough to meet demand? Because people are talking a lot about measles in the Pittsburgh region now.
Yeah, we have 375 doses available, so it's really a first-come, first-served situation. We may run out. We're not sure how many people are going to come. So, it's from 12 to 4 and, should come early if you want the vaccine. But there are other alternatives. There are plenty of places that give the MMR vaccine. So it's not like this is the only opportunity.
MMR, measles, mumps, rubella, correct?
Correct, yeah. And we do have an immunization clinic downtown that's open Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 9 to 4 and on Wednesdays from 1 to 8. And people can also go there to get the shot.
Are you arranging for additional doses in case you don't have enough to meet demand?
I think we'll see how it goes today, and then we'll consider what the next steps are.
Okay. What is the latest as far as cases of measles in our area?
So we still have 5 confirmed cases in our area. One was an imported case from overseas, and another was an imported case from overseas that affected a family. So we have one single case, and then we have 4 cases in a family.
And all involved international travel in some way.
Right. So the only local transmission was within a family here. Mm-hmm. It's still too early to see if we'll get more cases or not. The time from when you're exposed to measles to when you get a rash is between 7 and 21 days, on average about 14 days. So we're still watching closely to see if anyone else develops a rash, a fever and a rash illness.
And because of that longer incubation period, I guess, does that sort of keep you waiting to see what you can do because of that 7 to 21 day range?
The main people who need to be concerned are people who were in the areas of exposure, which we've listed in the press. The people who should be worried watch for symptoms are those who were at those places and who are not vaccinated. If you're vaccinated, you're probably protected. It's a very good vaccine. But for some of those places, the time period of watching for symptoms is over. For example, the airport, and today I think it's the last day for the restaurant. Some of the other places, we still recommend watching for the full 3 weeks.
Those other locations that your department released earlier this week were the Milky Way restaurant in Squirrel Hill, the National Aviary, and the Red, White, and Blue thrift store in Ohio River Boulevard, I believe.
Yeah, that is correct. And we had a couple exposures at Giant Eagle and Aldi, also in April 26th and 28th as well.
Right. Can you give us an idea about how many people in Allegheny County are not vaccinated or conversely are vaccinated against measles?
The best data that we have are from school children, and for our school children of all grades entering, about 97% had 2 doses of the MMR vaccine. So our school age population is very well protected. Mm-hmm. We assume our adults are pretty well protected, too, though we don't have good data on those. And, of course, everyone born before 57 is probably protected as well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned school-age children. So this waiting period, this 1 to 3 week incubation period to see if more cases might develop, are you concerned? How would you put it, especially in school districts where maybe the vaccination rate is not as high as you would like it to be?
We haven't had any cases in school-age children at all. So we haven't had any exposures in schools. So far, I think we're okay on that front. If that does happen, you know, there's certain measures we take at the school, but so far, no transmission to school-age children.
We're hearing from some adults born in, I believe, the 60s who might have received the dead vaccine. Should they be concerned? What should they do?
Yeah, if the only vaccine you've received was between 1963 and 1967, it's a good idea to be revaccinated. Other adults who aren't sure if they've had a vaccine or not, and they're not sure if they've had disease or not, they can either get a blood test to see if they have antibodies to the virus, or they can get another shot.
My final question, Dr. Mertz, what precautions are you taking? What precautions are our public health officials taking to prepare for if it gets worse, that there are more cases?
Well, we have a pretty good team here at the health department, so we're prepared to do all the contact tracing and all the work that goes into having a measles outbreak. We also have good support from the state health department, and we're learning a lot from New York and other places that have big outbreaks on what are the most effective measures to take. But we are really committed to trying to provide enough vaccine for everybody who needs it and to do all the follow-up we need to do.
Dr. Kristen Mertz is a medical epidemiologist with the Allegheny County Health Department. Dr. Mertz, thanks so much and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The 4th annual Remake Learning Days get underway tomorrow and continue through May 19th, showcasing a variety of hands-on learning approaches and activities. Joining us in studio is Sunana Chan, Director of Remake Learning, the Pittsburgh-based education network. Welcome to The Confluence, Sunana.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
I called Remake Learning a network. Remind us, who comprises the organization? What are the shared goals?
So Remake Learning is a professional network here in the Pittsburgh region. I like to say an hour and a half driving radius of downtown Pittsburgh, comprised of thousands of educators, both in and out of school, researchers, higher education folks, philanthropists, government folks, who are all trying to think about engaging, relevant, and equitable learning mm-hmm. in this time of remarkable technological and societal change.
And community organizations, we wouldn't maybe necessarily think of education, but then maybe how they support learning?
Absolutely. So not just schools, although a lot of schools are involved, but libraries and museums, out-of-school organizations, all of the places where kids learn both in and out of school.
And full disclosure, WESA is a part of that network. So you already had this network of stakeholders, organizations concerned about the overall education of students in and out of the classrooms. What's the purpose of Remake Learning Days?
Remake Learning Days is to turn that network into a regional open house for the future of learning. And so if you imagine all of those organizations, schools, museums, libraries, businesses, opening their doors and showcasing what the future of education, the future of learning looks like in our region, that's Remake Learning Days. So almost 300 events across Southwest Pennsylvania and West Virginia highlighting that incredible work.
All right. So nearly 300 events. They're in lots of different spaces
yes.
as well. A lot of different communities. That's important,
absolutely.
Too. Any favorites? Now, I'm asking you to pick a couple of favorites among 300, but go ahead.
I cannot pick favorites, but I will tell you a few just to give you an idea of
all
the
right.
breadth of activity. So tomorrow night, I'll be going to Youth Voices Live, which is kind of a radio podcast, this type of environment, actually, but with young people, and that's going to be at the Homewood Brush and YMCA.
Mm-hmm.
Trinity Area School District is having an underwater Rover competition. The Carnegie Libraries are doing all kinds of work, all hands-on tech work. There's arts events, there's music events, there's robotics and engineering events, and they are all open to the public. So I would encourage anyone to go on the website, search for your zip code, and find something near you.
All right. A lot of the events, they're all listed online at remakelearningdays.org. Sort of wild to my ear. In addition to what you mentioned, rocket launches,
yes,
hip hop classes,
yes,
virtual reality brunch, gaming workshops. How innovative are they really to today's kids growing up as digital natives?
Absolutely. So, you know, Joe was just talking about it in terms of kids needing to be creative and hands-on and building and making and doing. This morning on WSA, I heard a story about computer-assisted telepathy between humans.
Yes.
The world is changing so fast, and students need all kinds of different experiences to prepare them for this ever-changing world. And so whether it's hip-hop or robotics, you know, and everything in between and those things combined, we need all kinds of ways for students to interact with this changing world and to have more, again, engaging and relevant experiences.
That's the key, the engaging. And it doesn't necessarily all have to be digital and high tech.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There are all kinds of ways that kids can be creative and collaborative and problem solvers that have nothing to do with technology, but are going to be so incredibly relevant to our to this kind of new society and changing world.
Can the parents get involved in these Remake Learning Days, and how so?
Absolutely. So these days are designed for parents, community members to get involved and to go. And so Remake Learning Days is all about intergenerational learning. We encourage parents, caregivers, grandmothers, aunts, uncles to come to these events with children and youth and experience the future of learning themselves and do robotics and coding and all of these things and hip-hop themselves and really kind of have that joy and spark of learning also.
Well, let me ask you about the age range that these events appeal to.
Sure.
Because obviously you'll want parents with some of the younger ones, but maybe some of the older kids that might say, Mom, Dad, yeah, you know, stay at home or drop me off.
Sure. The age range for kids is anywhere from pre-K through 12th grade. And again, parents, community members, adults are encouraged to come to any and all of them. And you can search by age on the website as well, in addition to location or theme, all kinds of ways to find an event that's relevant to you.
Remake Learning Days began in Pittsburgh. They aren't just in Pittsburgh anymore. So, Nana, tell us about how you're spreading the gospel of Remake Learning Days and where.
So last year we had a few cities that came to Pittsburgh for Remake Learning Days saying, we want a community-wide celebration about the future of learning. How do we do this in our own place? And so what has happened is that seven other regions outside of Pittsburgh are now doing Remake Learning Days, and it's taking root in culturally and contextually specific ways from rural eastern Kentucky to Chicago to Chattanooga to North Carolina and beyond. And we just couldn't be more excited that that they're taking this Pittsburgh model and using it to such great effect in other places.
Have they started, or is it all tied into this May time period?
They have. So Knoxville and Kentucky actually happened in April, and they were incredible. In Kentucky, there were 71 events in rural Kentucky, from making corn husk dolls to events at centers of faith to schools to museums and libraries as well. Again, doing it in a way that was very relevant to Appalachia.
Are they doing things differently? In other words, are there some ideas you can borrow and bring back to Pittsburgh?
Absolutely. Just the amazing amount of on-the-ground community work that's happening in these places and really knocking on doors and saying, you're doing incredible work. Come be part of this larger celebration. I think in Kentucky, making all types of different organizations, from cafes to restaurants to sewing shops, feel involved and engaged in Remake Learning Days and feel as though they have something to offer is something that we could do a lot more of here. And I'm excited to bring next year to Remake Learning Days.
In just a couple of sentences. So how do you measure the success of the Remake Learning Network, the Remake Learning Days? And I mean beyond the number of organizations in the network, events in the Remake Learning Days. How do you measure the impact on kids, their families?
Sure. So over the past, we do some extensive evaluation, and over the past 3 years of Remake Learning Days, we've seen an 11% increase, which is statistically significant, in the amount of parent familiarity with this concept of STEAM, with this concept of interdisciplinary learning, science, technology, engineering, arts, arts and math. We see that parents are more familiar with this concept of remaking learning and are, you know, better able to express and experience it in their own communities.
Remake Learning Days begin tomorrow, continue through May 19th. We'll have a link to the full events calendar on our website, WESA.FM. Sunanna Chand is the director of Remake Learning, the Pittsburgh-based education network. Sunanna, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, we continue to see violent, deadly acts of hatred locally in other parts of the country. Is the hate movement growing locally, nationally? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovic and Meg Fair. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.